Well, we'd like to welcome everybody tonight. We're glad Karen's with us tonight. Thanks for everybody listening in to tonight's teleseminar with Karen Scholl. I'm your host, Melinda Garish. My husband and I, we own Cutnut Stables here in Shirley, Indiana. And if you're in our area, we please ask you to stop on by, and we'd love to have you stay with us. So let's get started, Karen. The weather's getting better out this way, and we're all wanting to start riding some more. And of course, we want to have fun with the horses, but we also want to stay safe at the same time. So we've got a lot of topics that we're going to be discussing tonight, and we appreciate everybody getting their questions in. It's amazing how many questions are coming in, and some of the topics are similar to last month's, and then some, we've got some new questions out there. So we're going to be dealing with rearing and also an extreme behavior as well as cribbing. Then it's a trailer loading issue, but in this case, it's an unloading issue. And fear, leadership, pony behavior, pecking order, and aggressive behavior. Canter transitions, if we get a chance to get back to that. We did discuss that last month. And then some clinic locations. So, Karen, are you ready to get started here with the questions?
You bet. I'll talk fast, I promise.
I was like, oh, my gosh, we got all these neat questions to find out. So we want everybody to stay safe. So this one's from Sally, and she's in Flagstaff. And since we've got so many questions here we want to get through, I'm going to condense this down, and then if you need a little bit more information, we'll dig through this question and see what else you need. But she's wanting to know what she can do. She's got Tabby as a 9-year-old. Quarter horse mare that has what she would consider a left brain introvert. She bought her a little over 2 years ago, at which she was a 30 days under saddle as a 2-year-old and was used as a brood mare. In May of last year, she audited your 2-day clinic in Flagstaff and purchased your complete DVD set. Overall, she's very smart and has taken to learning everything we have practiced from your program. I'm hoping to get your advice on some behavior that my horse exhibits, which of rearing up, both under halter and when I'm on her back. To keep us both safe, and so I don't reinforce her bad behavior, I'm hoping for advice on the following if the behavior occurs either on the ground or from above. So she wants to know, what can I do to divert her energy when I feel she's about to go up? And if she does rear, my confidence would be increased if I knew what to do during the moments her front feet are off the ground. And as well as, what techniques do I put in motion once she's all of her feet are back on the ground again? So those are kind of the questions there, Karen.
Denise, okay. DeAngelis. There are a lot of suggestions and approaches that are out there as far as rearing horses. Everything from, you know, carrying a water balloon or an egg and cracking it over their head so they think that they hit their head and the blood's dripping down their head, to, you know, smacking the cannon bones, you know, 6 times, you know, and striking their legs. You know, there's all kinds of advice out there. I'm getting feedback, Melinda. Do we need to mute again?
I'm going to, and then try to unmute yourself, okay?
But it's actually a very simple answer, and it'll be something, Sally, that when you hear it, you'll go, why didn't I think of that? Basically, the engine of the horse and the powerful position that horse gets into, whether it's bucking, rearing, pee-offing, spinning, slide stops, any of those things, the energy and the position comes from the hindquarters. When you disengage the hindquarters, you're taking the power away. A horse cannot rear when it's disengaging the hindquarters. And whether you're on the ground or on the horse's back, disengaging the hindquarters is the key to prevent many things. If I feel a horse is going to kind of bow up and buck when I start a colt and that colt gets a little bit tight, I disengage the hindquarters. I disengage it again. I wait until the entire spine, clear from the tip of the nose down to the tip of the tail, feels soft. So disengaging the hindquarters isn't just one little step. you may need to disengage the hindquarters as much as you need to reestablish leadership both on the ground and up on the horse's back. So my advice when a horse rears, if you get to that point where the horse is rearing, there's really the safest thing to do, and where rearing becomes very, very dangerous, is when the horse goes up on the back legs, the tendency of the human is to pull on the bridle. And that's where you hear of a horse flipping over backwards and landing on the person, causing, you know, pretty serious injuries. But if you can prepare the horse from the things that we did in the clinic and the things that you've seen on the videos and do even more disengagement of the hindquarters, then when your horse gets into a situation where they're under duress, then you will automatically take the hindquarters away and disempower the hindquarters and take the leadership back. And it's really interesting that this question came up today, because this morning I went on my less experienced horse, Deb, to move cattle. And it was a brisk morning this morning. I'm helping my friend Dan Moyer move some cattle, and he had never been on cattle before, and this cow had her calf kind of brushed up in the brush, and it was all rustly, and the wind was blowing in a crisp morning, and I'll tell you what, Deb's debutante started levitating, and there were so many things coming at him that, boy, he got really up. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just, you know, bend his head, and I'll just, you know, kind of disengage her a little bit, and then he'll just kind of settle in, and we'll just follow this cow and calf, and we'll just go in behind and everything. Well, Dan's up there in the brush and the cow and calf and everything. I did what this advice is this morning. He got to a point where I was holding him with a bit because he kind of wanted to charge forward into this deal, but at the same time, he was all tense from the situation. And I'll tell you what, I disengaged his hindquarters, I can't count how many times. And I don't mean just one step and let him go. We went into a circle until he turned loose mentally and emotionally to me. Because when a horse gets scared, you're not in the leadership position anymore. And what a horse doesn't need when it's scared, or it wants to get home, or it wants to get with the other horses, or get away from something or fill in the blank, when a horse is afraid, they're not looking to you for leadership in that moment. And that's when you need to assert yourself to take that leadership position back. So it's really funny that this question came up today, because people say, oh, well, you have well-trained horses and these things don't happen to you and this is like theory for you. I'll tell you what, you will use this until you don't have horses anymore, because you will always find a threshold situation that will put you in that position where the horse starts acting like a prey animal, no matter how much training or background or whatever has happened or any of those things or what type of character the horse is. It's always looking to leadership in a situation. So my expectation of my horse is that, and I know I've said this before in the teleseminars, I used to hold in my mind, you know what, even when you're scared, look to me for leadership. But I've changed that in recent years. Especially when you're scared, look to me for leadership. And if the horse isn't looking to me for leadership in those situations, whatever it is, whether it's bucking or wanting to go faster or fill in the blank, Bergante. I do the same thing with Bergante. If he says, hey, I know we're going back to the arena, I'll just take you there at my speed, I will take his hindquarters away until he turns loose to me again. So that's a common term with horses. You want that horse to turn loose to you. When that horse starts making a decision, rearing is just one of many decisions a horse can make. Simply, now, if they're in the rearing position, what goes up must come down. And if they can stay up there longer than 5 minutes, you know, I'll offer to buy the horse from you, because that's pretty athletic. So when a horse rears up, don't do anything more than just, you know, let that rein be loose, let him come back down, step down on the ground, okay? That's what I would do if it got much, you know, and Deb wasn't in a situation where I needed to step down, but it crossed my mind that was definitely an option. Get that hindquarters disengaged on the ground. And that's what you'll always come back to, no matter how much time you have with a horse or how experienced or whatever. Every horse has a threshold. Conditions change. And that should be your parachute that's always there, and you step back and use it, and don't wait to see if your horse is going to rear I didn't wait to see if Deb was going to rear. I didn't wait to see how bad this was going to get. I took his hindquarters away when he started making the decisions and wasn't following my suggestions anymore. So I hope that that helps you, Sally. Disengaging the hindquarters on the ground gets leadership on the ground. Disengaging the hindquarters up on the horse's back is even more so. So, but again, don't wait until you're in a situation like all the other horses are leaving you or something like that. That's probably another thing, is prevent that situation from happening. Sometimes people go out on a group ride and they go, well, my horse should be able to go away from the other horses. The other horses should be able to go home and I should be able to stand here quietly. Well, you know, you may not be at that stage with that horse. So rather than getting into a big fight with a horse, you kind of see where they're at and maybe ride away from the group and then ride back in and then ride away and ride back in. Kind of find where every horse is at, find their threshold and keep stretching it. So I hope that kind of prevention is the key, preparation is the key, but knowing what to do in those situations is the key. And once the horse comes back down, lands on its two front feet, please do not, that is probably the one thing I hear people say, you got to get after him. Well, you know what? It's too late by then. It's what happened before the rearing that you want to take a little bit different approach and prevent it from happening. So by the time the horse rears, when the horse comes back down, just go, wow, I didn't have enough leadership for these conditions. Then go back to square one and get your leadership even better. So when your horse gets scared, your horse still looks to you for leadership.
Okay. She's also got a little bit further question here, and since she has purchased your DVD set, she's looking for a direction of what to focus on. Karen, she said she's got, you know, a dominant mare, and there's certain lessons that she wants to know she should focus on more so than others, and certain things not to do knowing her particular personality. Is there anything you want to direct her toward in your DVDs?
Sure. Probably the biggest thing is, you know, and I hear a lot of people talk about, you know, the horse is a dominant mare, or, you know, this horse is an Arabian. I hear different breeds, different characters, all kinds of different things. The thing to keep going back to is you put that mare out in a pasture with a herd of horses and say, you put them in with my horses, my mares, Bergante and Deb, how would they treat her? And the answer is they would treat her like a horse. Now, after, you know, a certain amount of time, maybe she would come out as the lead horse. And this is another piece here. I'm very particular in word choice. You've noticed that if you've been watching my DVDs or been to a clinic. I do not use or adopt the word dominance with horses, because dominance demands submission from others. And I think it's a very misunderstood word among humans. That's why I'm very particular in replacing that word dominance with leadership. I got really stuck for a lot of years with the mentality of I'm the dominant horse and you will do my bidding. When I changed that attitude and approach on my part, where I said, you know what, I'm going to focus and learn leadership skills, I'm going to be such a tremendous and influential leader, you will surrender your mind, your heart, your thoughts to me. Not because I demanded it, but because I invited it. So dominance demands submission while leadership invites surrender. And some people say, well, surrender is losing. You lose when you surrender. And I go, oh, but I differ. Because a surrender is a choice. You don't have to surrender. You could fight to the death. You know, but if you have a certain approach with horses, and it's funny, it seems like that wouldn't be a really big thing, but a horse, especially mares are more serious than geldings. Geldings want to mess with you. They're very playful. They have a different kind of outlook on things. Mares are more serious. They're less tolerant. And if you don't approach a mare, it's kind of like, you know, the same with mules. You have to treat a mule the way you should treat a horse. And I kind of like to transfer that to mares. You have to be as good with a mare as you should be with a gelding, because mares are just less tolerant. So it's kind of a funny thing. It's not a dominance thing, but a leadership thing. So when I go in and I ask for a very subtle suggestion to move a certain body part, say move the hindquarters, and the horse kind of says, well, in a minute, I'll go to a bite there pretty quick because, again, I'm demonstrating behavior that another horse would, and not just any horse, the lead horse. And I know I kind of harp on the leadership part of it, but it's so key to getting across. Leadership is not aggression. I don't say, man, you get after the horse. I don't ever say that. It's not about getting after the horse. It's does your skill, does your timing, does your bite feel effective to that horse? And let me tell you if it's effective. It's effective if you can go back in and just with a slight suggestion and focus at that hindquarters. Is that horse, take that hindquarters away and say, yes, ma'am, how fast, how far? See? And then when I bite the horse, I go, hee, 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 you were too slow. Because it's a game between horses. Who bites who is a game. They don't do it with anger. And you can see a horse pin its ears and go at another horse. And we think, oh, he's mad. But 2 minutes later, they're eating out of the same hay pile. Or the ears are back flat, the teeth are out, and 2 seconds later, the ears are forwards and they've forgotten the whole thing. So this is one of the hazards that humans have. We tend to look at a horse and we say, well, if that horse is appearing aggressive towards another horse, it means they're mad at that horse. Because that's what humans do, and especially women. If we get assertive towards another person, it's because our emotions have come up first. So this is a particular challenge that a lot of women have, is how do we learn to demonstrate assertiveness without the emotional attachment to it? So when I'm assertive with a horse, I get people at clinic and I say, who is surprised how assertive I am with these horses? And people are going, I am. I thought it was coming to horsemanship for women and we were all going to sing kumbaya and you know, show our love for each other. It's like, I do love this horse. I love this horse so much. I'm like the mama horse that nips her baby that says, listen, Junior, I need you to move now. You and our life depends on it. So I think when people take a little bit different approach on that assertiveness piece, that horse instantly recognizes the leadership, recognizes that you're doing this for them and not to them, and that horse just will follow you to the ends of the earth. They don't follow you to the ends of the earth because you rub them and kiss them and, you know, give them, you know, praise and cookies and good girl or good boy. They will follow the lead horse, you know, into battle because of the assertiveness that they're willing to demonstrate at every moment. That is a prey animal psychology. That is a survival mechanism and the nature of the horse. So if that kind of helps, you know, conceptually, then you'll know what to do technically.
Okay, lots of great information there. So, and that was all in one person's question.
That was all said in one breath.
Yeah. Yeah, take a breath there. Okay, so, well, Karen, we've got another one from Jill, and if you're ready, I'm going to go ahead and go right on into it. So it's almost 8:30 already. This one's on extreme behavior in cribbing, and it says, you know, Karen, thanks for the opportunity. She enjoys the teleseminars. I have a gelding that I have had for about 5 years, and he's now 8, and he was started briefly when I got him. He had been tied with a stud shank with his previous owner, and he has scars across his nose from that or a tie down that was used when he was started under saddle. Anyway, he is an extreme horse with high energy, quick, impulsive, hyper alert, high-headed, bracy, overreactive, unpredictable, very claustrophobic, and will sometimes kick out behind him when nothing is there. He has never kicked anyone, just sometimes when he is very worried, he will kick out behind almost as a reflex. Her question is, what can I do to help him? Are there just some horses that just never become calm, confident, and brave? She says she's worked together for the past 5 years and can do amazing things at Liberty and Bridleless, but if I give him any time off or something changes in his surroundings, he gets extreme all over again. It is like he is always on hyper alert. I understand that it is about me. Do you have any suggestions on how I can get better leader for this horse?
Yeah. And I'll tell you that, you know, Jill, you already know the answer because you say, you know, how can I become a better leader? I'll tell you, a lot of times when horses are hypervigilant or appear frightened or appear scared, our tendency, when a horse gets scared or tight, we tend to back off. And we say, well, I can't bite him because he's already scared, and so that will scare him more. And it's a really funny thing. I just finished a three-day clinic in Grand Junction, Colorado, and there was a horse in there, a beautiful paint gated horse, and owned by the gal, and just as sweet as could be. She was sweet. The mare was sweet. And I mean, this mare was voted most likely to survive in the wild. She was just up and out and all these things. And I had that mare in my hands a few times, you know, during the clinic. What was really amazing and was a very difficult concept for the owner to understand is how my biting the horse made the horse calmer. Because she just said, you know, and actually it was really sweet because before the clinic she stopped me and she said hi and she introduced herself and said, I'm so glad to be here, but I need to tell you, you know, my mare is very high-strung and very sensitive and very, you know what, every horse is high-strung and sensitive under certain conditions, especially when they don't perceive a leader present. Sometimes, and this is kind of like my detective analytical mind, when you said, you know, horse was started with a tie down, tied with a stud chain, has scars across the nose, that is even more reason for the human to back off and soften when actually the horse needs more leadership and a suggestion of movement followed by a bite for understanding. So it's really interesting the progress over a three-day course. It seems like, you know, okay, we'll just spend a lot of time and we'll tire this horse out and ride it a lot and do circles and do all these things and then the horse will calm down. But if the horse does not perceive leadership present, then in that horse's mind, it's in the lead position and it's scared. So it's just like people. Some people are natural leaders. Other people, if they're in charge of something, oh my gosh, that is the last thing. They want to be in a support role, not in a lead role. So, and some horses have that approach as well. Not every horse has the nature to be the lead horse. So even though this horse has had a bad, well, I won't say a bad start, a less than optimal start, because, you know, I don't know exactly what happened with the horse, but the question really is what do you do right now? And I think that in the previous question, talking about the horse rearing, you could take those same principles, those same concepts, and watch the DVDs. And when you see me bite these horses, it actually has a calming effect. And it's really such an opposite result of what most people think. And right now what's happening, your horse lacks confidence, because it doesn't perceive leadership as present. So the fastest way to establish leadership, I've had horses at demos and expos. One mare in, I think it was Michigan, came in. She was screaming so loud. She was so out of her mind in that situation. I went and checked to make sure that my demo horse wasn't a stallion. I mean, that it sounded like a stud horse just screaming his guts out, and it wasn't. It was a mare, and she was that distressed, and the owner told me a very similar story that this is just how this mare is. Well, we got her safely to the arena, got her in there, and I just let her kind of tear around on a long line, and I didn't really exist, and she was just fretting and fretting. Here's this audience and all this stuff, and people are thinking, well, you know what, she needs to just get used to the audience, and, oh, she hasn't trailered for farther than 5 miles or whatever, fill in the blank. But all I did was I just directed her feet, bite, and instantly, it was like a transformation in front of your eyes. The mare stopped, looked at me, and said, oh, thank goodness, you're in charge. She held her feet still. She relaxed. She was on a loose line. She stood there with her back leg cocked for the next 10 minutes. She literally did not move another muscle. She said, I'm not afraid anymore because you act like a horse. You speak my language, and I can relax now. And I looked at the owner, and I said, you look surprised. And she said, how did you? You know, and people think, well, you hit the horse, and it calmed it down. And I didn't hit it. I was directing it. And once that horse realizes that you can direct its motion and it develops the willingness to have that motion directed, it'll like I said, surrender its motion and direction and mind to you. That's the psychological effect that this is having with the horse. So that's what I would do is I would just start at square one. I'd start with a stick and a string, a halter and lead. I'd start killing ants. I would do that until the horse didn't just tolerate it but accepted it. Now, there's another piece that you said, Jill, that strikes me, and I want to mention it here. Liberty and bridleless riding do not have a communication using steady pressure. It has a communication using rhythmic pressure, which I talk about in the Cornerstone for Communication, because horses, by nature, between horses, they use rhythmic pressure. They don't go up and, you know, take the other horse in their teeth and drag it, you know, lead it. Steady pressure, pressure that actually physically touches the horse, causes an opposite reaction. The natural response to steady pressure, something touching the horse and putting pressure, physically touching the horse, causes the horse to push through it. Because if you think about it in the wild, the only thing that delivers steady pressure to a horse is usually a predator, and usually the sharp parts of the predator, because it's designed to touch the hair first, down to the skin, into the muscle, and down to the bone. So the horse, when it feels steady pressure, when a foal is haltered for the first time, or a horse is saddled for the first time, or when a horse is tied for the first time, oftentimes the reaction, it triggers the survival mechanism to push through that steady pressure. So I've seen lots of people get really good at two of the four categories to become good at with horses. And those categories are oftentimes liberty and freestyle riding or bridleless riding. But if you use steady pressure, either online with a lead rope or some sort of line, or finesse type riding where you pick the horse up and you're using steady pressure to move the horse, like the horse should feel like pushing a bubble in a bathtub, you know, with your steady pressure. Oftentimes that falls apart because the horse is simply not taught to move away from steady pressure. So that's why you're finding a great result with liberty and freestyle riding, but online, you know, say the horse is tied and maybe under saddle, I don't know, you haven't mentioned whether that is the case or not, those areas are oftentimes a struggle. And that's why I address those things very early on in the beginning and talk about how you can use rhythmic pressure to support your steady pressure. But it's the release of the pressure. Always remember, the only reason I'm putting pressure on a horse is to give the horse comfort when they're demonstrating a behavior that I would like to see more of. So again, pressure, when it's demonstrated from the horse's point of view in a very fair way, that pressure, what you want a horse to understand is pressure is not punishment. Pressure is simply for communication. But it's got to be pressure in a way that another horse would do it for them to understand.
Okay. Karen, she also has another part of this that she has a question on, so we'll kind of fill this in a little bit as well. She said he was also kept in a 12 by 24 stall with 100 by 60 paddock with horses near him for several years because he would jump the fence in the pasture and then run to the barn. 6 months ago, she finally got him turned out in a field with 5 mares, and within 2 months, he has started cribbing on the wood fences. He has pasture and the mares with good health care. He's never cribbed until he was turned out, and he's never been around another horse that cribs. And she's wanting to know, have you ever heard of such a thing, and should she put him back in the barn?
See, it's usually the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually the opposite. A horse that's put in a confined area oftentimes will be distressed enough, if they're separated from other horses, will begin to crib in that kind of an environment. Usually when a horse goes out into pasture, especially if there's grass and things like that, usually there is something active for the horse to be doing, grazing little bits all day long. So it's usually the opposite. That's
odd, isn't it?
That's pretty unusual to see that.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I can think of, and I have seen horses that, you know, horses' teeth are wearing all the time, you know, throughout their entire lifetime. So they're growing and wearing And I don't know, I would rule out if there's anything physical with a horse, and equine dentists are available really pretty much across the country. I would have somebody that specializes in dentistry take a look at the feet. But, you know, please get recommendations by a veterinarian or people that you know, because you really want to check that out. The other thing I found is that horses, I know it drives people crazy, but horses chew on wood. And when my horses are in pasture at my house, I throw big hunks of wood in there. And they go in and just chew away and, you know, have a good time. And I know people try to avoid that all over the place, but I don't know that it's such an unnatural thing for the horse to do. And I probably shouldn't say that, because some horse will probably get a splinter and people will say, well, that's Garrett Schultz's fault. But and you make your own decision. I have not had a horse had any kind of a problem, and I think that sometimes, you know, if it's not something physical, I think it may be something natural for a horse to tend to kind of want to do. Sometimes people say wood chewing is around mineral supplementation, you know, things like that. Now, if the horse is chewing wood, that's different than cribbing. Cribbing is taking, they can do it on pipe or wood or, you know, anything, and they'll hook their front teeth over something solid and they'll set back and pull back, which opens the flap that closes the airway from the esophagus. There's actually two separate paths. It's not like us where we share the same air hole where the food goes in also. So there's actually two separate paths, and there's a flap there that kind of can go between that. It's like when if you need to put a soft, flexible tube down a horse's nose into their stomach, I really recommend a veterinarian doing that, because there's a way to set it down in there, and through their feel, they can get it past that flap and down into the stomach. But sometimes it's a horse is doing when they crib and they lock their front teeth and pull back, they're opening that flap and getting air down into their stomach. And it's a real problem, because horses' teeth, it actually causes an endorphin release. And so the horse is basically getting high on endorphins when they're doing that. Now, there is a tool, and I've been given one to use, because and I don't know that I agree or I disagree with it, but if a horse is wearing its teeth down because it's cribbing, because it's a, you know, basically a drug addict on endorphins, I would not rule it out. I don't like it when people have an absolute yes and an absolute no. So I was given a tool called a vice breaker, and it's basically an electric shock collar for horses. Now, I have not come into a situation where I have had to use it. So I've carried it around for probably 3 years now and not had a use for it. And the people with vice breaker are saying, well, you know, surely you come across something you can't fix, you know, behaviorally, and I haven't so far. But this sounds like if you're putting a horse out in a pasture and it's starting to crib, it's such an unusual behavior that something like this might be something that you would consider, especially if the horse is wearing down its teeth and causing harm to itself. So like I said, I don't have any absolutes on it, but I would use just a very, very mild setting. And people hate this idea, but if you're going to use an electric shock collar on a dog or a horse, you should feel every setting yourself. So when you set it up, and if you choose to use something like that on either a dog or a horse, you put that collar, maybe not on your neck, but into your hand, and you hit the button, and you feel what it's going to feel like to your animal. Because oftentimes I think what people do is they aren't willing to do that, and if you're not willing to put it on yourself, I don't think we really have the right to put it on an animal and use it. But it could be something that could help your horse prevent it from harm. And so that's why I say it may be something, if you're seeing an unusual behavior like that, that may be something for you to consider trying.
So Karen, do you think, since he was normally in the barn and the stall, that's kind of his comfort zone, and he's got all these extreme behaviors, that since he's out and about, you know, this is kind of a symptom of his anxiety of being out there? I mean, is that possible?
It could be, but usually a horse's nature is that they're more comfortable out in the open. And it could be, you know, he was raised, you know, animals. I was talking about with a gentleman today. There was a fellow who used a mule down in the mines, and I'm sure everybody's heard the stories that, you know, when in absence of light, in pitch black, an animal, a horse or a mule that's used down in the mines, they don't need their vision anymore, and they actually go blind. And when they come out into daylight, I mean, if they still have their vision, they're actually very uncomfortable and want to get back down into the mines. So, yes, you know, it could be a pattern that the horse is expressing anxiety, wanting to be back into the barn, but it doesn't mean that you can't reshape that behavior either until the horse becomes comfortable outside either. So, to me, the horse should be
really
comfortable. Yeah, to me, it should be the horse should be comfortable in a barn, in a tie stall, in a big stall, in a little stall, outside, you know, inside, in the bedroom of your kid's room, you know. Any of those.
Mike doesn't like when I bring him in the house.
I know it.
he has a problem with that.
I know. One day I hear of people that build these houses where the bottom half of the house is the barn. I was like, that's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that was a good one, interesting one there. So we've got another one here from Jen, and her first word is help with the exclamation point. So that's the need there, and it's my horse will load into my trailer but won't back out of it. She says she has a two-horse trailer with a ramp, and getting him in is not a problem. He's calm in the trailer, too, no problem there. Issue is when I need to get him out. He won't back out of it. He's scared to death. He'll walk out of it just fine, though. I've done lots of groundwork with him. He backs just fine. Do you have any suggestions for me or techniques I could try to get him to back out? I thought your trailer loading video.
You said he walks out of it, meaning he'll turn around and walk out of it?
Well, that's what I'm thinking she must be doing. She must be turning him around and then walking him out. But he won't back and step down off of it, or... But it's got a ramp to it as well, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll tell you what my approach would be. Is first I would start on the ground, just like, you know, without the trailer, and I would back the horse down, step off a wash rack or a grooming area. I'd back the horse into the stall with a little step over. I'd set up cavalettis and have the horse where they have to, you know, back up and step up over things. I would have the horse backing up and down and into and around things until that horse would just, you know, back up a flight of stairs. So
that horse is just backing up wherever it goes.
I take every opportunity, you know, I go into strange places all the time, and I'll see a stall and it's kind of closed in, and the door's kind of crooked and it's kind of squeezy, and I go, you know, or dark in it, and I go, oh boy, I get to back my horse into this goofy place. You know, and people kind of go, you know, what is the matter with that lady? You know, I didn't see this, you know, lead the horse in, but I like to find things. I like to see if I can back both my horses, stand between two stalls. I pulled into a place a couple weeks ago, and I thought, ooh, I want to see if I could stand in the middle and communicate to both my horses and have them back into their stalls next to each other at the same time. See? So that's backing. Yeah.
That's backing.
And somebody was far away watching going, what is she doing? Because, of course, my horses didn't just go, oh, yes, Karen, we can telepathically understand you. You know, they got all backwards and turned around and all kinds of things, and I just kept fiddling around until I found it. And both the horses backed in, and somebody came up from far away and said, you know, I was watching you going, what the heck is she doing? I can't even tell what she's doing. And they said they were so surprised when all of a sudden both those white horses just backed beautifully into those stalls. And so that's backing. The other thing is make sure that the horse backs from steady pressure on the nose or the halter. So when I ask a horse to back out of a trailer, I have a feel on that lead rope, and I bring them back with the steady pressure on the halter. One of the things where horses lose confidence backing out of a trailer is that we'll put a feel on that halter, and they'll start to back out and we don't continue the feel backwards. And so, and it's not in this case where a horse has a ramp, but you'll see it sometimes a horse's back feet will step out. Then we don't communicate a feel that says keep backing. And then the horse will get kind of confused because it stepped down, and then it kind of says, well, maybe I need to jump back in, and they'll bang their back legs on a on the back of the trailer or something like that. So when I'm asking a horse to back out, I am actually keeping a feel on that lead rope. I'm standing back behind the horse, and I'm asking that horse, I'm putting the feel on that rope and directing that horse backwards until all 4 feet are out of that trailer. The last piece I would do is I would have that horse go back in and then back out and then back in, then bring it back out and then put it back in and have it come back out and back in and back out and back in and back out until that horse is as good backing out as it is going in. And that's the thing sometimes when, you know, people, a common question is, you know, I unlatch the horse, I open the back door, and the horse, you know, as soon as it hears the something, it comes shooting out of there. Well, so if that's the last thing you do and you walk away, then you just go, well, that's the last thing the horse remembers. So the last impression is a lasting impression as well. So if I have a horse that for whatever reason he comes out kind of kooky or backwards or fast or slow or whatever, I just go, hey, Gix, guess what? We get to do this again until we're good. So that's probably another thing, you know, to do as well. If the horse isn't backing out well, make sure it's a good, strong feel, and you just wait. And as soon as that horse starts to back out, lighten your feel. You don't have to, you know, rip their nose backwards. Just hold that feel and just say, good, now keep coming. So hopefully that will help you in that little situation right there.
Yeah. And, Jen, also, Karen's got DVDs on trailer loading. So if you need further assistance, there's definitely that DVD out there that would be helpful to check out. So do you have any discussion on your DVD there on the trailer loading or any input other than what you just said, or will she be able to see it on that?
Yeah, about 60 more minutes of
description
challenges. Yeah, you know, I wish I could tell everybody everything in these teleseminars, and I try to, you can tell. But really, that's why the DVDs are there, is so that you can study them. I tell people, you're going to watch them over and over and over. And I've done that, you know, in my development of my horsemanship skills. I've taken somebody's DVD and gone, man, I'm not sure what to do in this situation. I've run out of information. And I'll throw, you know, DVDs in that I've watched a bunch of times, and you'll see something completely different every time you watch it. So that's why I put the DVDs together, because it's so hard. You know, and somebody say to me, well, you know, they stopped me in a expo and they said, well, tell me how to load trailer load my horse. I went, you know, I wish I could. But hopefully that piece will help you with the helping the horse build the confidence again in your communication and your leadership while backing out.
Okay. Well, it looks like we've got time for another one here. So this one is from D&B Cannon, and he says he's got a quarter horse ex-roping horse who is afraid of everything coming up from behind him. And he's tried many things and just wanting some advice there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and it's funny, as you were asking the question, I was thinking more about the horse backing out of the trailer too. Make sure that horse, all of these horses, every horse you interact with, is comfortable and confident in every body part. What I would do with a horse like that in the Cornerstone for Communication video is the, you know, technique that I call killing ants. When you take a stick with a string on it, you're holding the effective center on the lead rope, and I would take that string and, you know, first rub it all over the horse's body, and then I would get to where you could take that stick and string, and I mean swat the ground with the rhythm of a windmill, you know, continuously be, you know, swatting the ground hard enough to kill ants. That's why I call it killing ants. It's not petting the ants. It's not tickling the ants. You would actually, if there was a big ant problem, they'd be dead, okay? And to me, what I would do is I would take that, I'd watch the Cornerstone for Communication. There's three different horses on there. None of them had been interacted with by me prior to the videoing. So you will see a variety of reactions from different horses. So the bad news about horses is that they're frightened of anything new, different, sudden, or abrupt from all different positions of their body. The good news about horses is that they very quickly desensitize to those kinds of things. And that's why we get along with horses so well. The problem is that recognizing that horses are pattern animals, probably 80 to 90, sometimes almost 95-98% of the time, we do most of our communication from standing in front of the horse's nose. So the horse is standing there going, well, that's where you should be. You should be up in front of me, you know, where I can keep an eye on you. Then, you know, you start with your communication up front, out in front of the horse's nose where they're most confident. Then continue with that same communication, take it back kind of behind their eye, along their neck, do that on both sides, then take that same communication, killing ants, by standing at their shoulder or back to around their stomach. Again, continuing to feel of effective center on that lead rope all the time. Do not tie a horse and do this. This is a common mistake that people have made, is using things called snubbing posts. There's nothing wrong with snubbing posts if they're used as a tool for communication. If you have a horse that sits back really hard and you can take a single wrap around it, teach a horse to follow a feel, but people have misused tools that I think historically were started out as a teaching tool and just tied a horse to a snubbing post, snub them up. I mean, that's why it's called a snubbing post, and just keep, you know, doing things till the horse gets used to it. That's like, you know, tying a girl to a tree and kissing her till she likes it. You know, it's not going to happen. But the horse would have no choice but to submit. So I like to do this without a snubbing post and simply hold the lead rope, keep the horse's nose facing me, and keep doing it until the horse starts desensitizing and building their confidence. Eventually, like in the clinic this weekend, every participant in there took this approach with their horse. Every single person in there, regardless of the history, the breed type, the character, any of those things, the people were standing behind the horse, facing the tail, spanking the ground on both sides of the horse as hard as they could. And those horses, because they had been had the approach that I was able to talk these people through, because they had come to a clinic and brought these horses, people were absolutely amazed that they were standing behind the horses. And these horses were taking a nap. So, and that was just a short amount of time. I said, who's surprised this didn't take, you know, 2 weeks? You know, people were like, yeah, I thought this would take, you know, it was the first morning of the first day of the clinic. But it's knowing the approach to take to be able to do that. And that's why I keep referring back to the videos. I wish I could verbally tell you the answer and have you be able to go, oh, I can picture that in my mind tonight. And now I have the feel to go and do that. So I'm going to put a little disclaimer in there. Don't go out there tomorrow and stand behind your horse and start killing ants. It's not going to go well. But if you will take the approach and study the approach that I provide in the Cornerstone for Communication. It's a very inexpensive little bit, you know, DVD. And like I said, you can watch it over and over and over. If you will take that approach, it will keep you safe, and you will be amazed how you'll be able to help that horse get through that really pretty fast, faster than you would imagine. If you knew what to do, you could get horses through things much, much quicker than you would think.
Okay. All right. I think we have time for one more real quick one. What do you think?
Sure.
Okay. Let's go on then. This one is from Stephanie in Grand Junction, and she has a problem horse. Well, she'll say a pony, and she wants to know, do they have the same mentality as horses? I know that mules are a bit different than horses, but what about ponies?
Ponies are very, very intelligent. All horses are intelligent, but ponies have a different view on life. And I tell people one of the things with ponies is that I'll look at a pony, I'll have ponies or miniatures or, you know, young horses or whatever in my demos, and I'll take one look at a pony and they bat their big brown eyes at me and I go, oh no, you have a really high cute factor. And people are going, well, what are you talking about with that? And I go, you know what? It seems like the cuter the horse, the less leadership has been demonstrated with the horse. People go along and they go, oh, it's a little baby foal. Oh, it's an orphan. Oh, it's a pony. You know, we'll just go along and the pony will like us because it's cute and it's little and it's fuzzy. I'll tell you what, little miniature horses, I see people treat them like dogs. And a horse is not a dog. It doesn't have the same mentality, thought process, any of those things. So when you describe a problem horse, to me, I don't really view horses as having problems. It's kind of like the Horse Whisperer movie. I don't deal with horses that, you know, people that have problem horses. I deal with horses that have, you know, problem people. Because every behavior that a horse demonstrates has been reinforced. Now, there's innate behavior, you know, different horses, just like us, we have a different character that we're born with. Then there's learned behavior, and that's what's reinforced. So with ponies, oftentimes the behavior that happens with ponies is similar to mules and similar to, you know, sometimes Mustangs, because they'll be a kind of a heavier, shorter necked horse, not all of them, but some of them, where they'll learn to pull from you. Because ponies are so quick, they're so compact, they're so smart, they will learn to pull the rope out of your hand. It's a very common pony thing. People think it's mules. But I see it very consistently with ponies, because ponies get tired of what we're doing. And once they learn that behavior, it's pretty, it's not a difficult behavior to change, but it's a very physical behavior to change. So depending on what the behavior is, I could address it, but it's kind of that same thing. You have to treat a pony the way you should treat a horse. So my guess is that this, you know, quote, problem pony isn't a problem pony. It's probably a very intelligent horse. Pony. It's a very intelligent, probably very playful, probably isn't being challenged enough, and people aren't using effective techniques with the pony as far as being effective in presenting the style of leadership that a pony needs. Now, I've done kind of an informal survey across the country, and I'll ask people to raise their hands if they have noticed that in a herd of horses, the pony or the miniature will usually be the lead horse in a herd. And it's really amazing how people will go, yeah, the pony does run the show. So leadership is kind of like when the other question was around the dominant mare. Well, mares tend to be the lead horse, especially in a wild herd. There will be an alpha mare. The stallion is not in the lead position. The stallion is in the position to protect the herd and to procreate with the mare. So it has a very different role. But the mare is oftentimes the oldest, most experienced, most confident horse in a wild herd. In non-wild herds, you'll see geldings be the lead horse and different dynamics. But it's funny, you'll usually see a pony or a miniature be the lead one. You'll notice it in dogs as well. The big, giant dogs that you would think, you know, Great Danes and Great Pyrenees and St. Bernards and things like that, you'll see a little Jack Russell Terrier, you know, or some little terrier kind of dog, Boston Terrier, running the show. And so it's kind of an interesting dynamic that you see with ponies. So again, leadership needs to be fair with a pony, needs to be effective with a pony, needs to be challenging with a pony, and, you know, just take a little bit different approach. Ponies are great teachers for people, especially when they're, you know, been labeled as the problem pony. That pony, I'm sure, is just going, oh yeah, I'm running the show. let me show you how ponies train people. So it's really, again, just focusing on your techniques, how effective you are, and just getting better and better all the time. And the pony will tell you how you're doing, whether you're worthy of its, you know, direction or not. So
yeah, they're pretty honest.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Karen, I can't believe it's already after 9 o'clock here. So time has gone really fast. We certainly appreciate you joining us tonight and all your passion and commitment that you have to helping us learn. And we congratulate you on your commitment, you and Mark. Congratulations on your 20th year together. And thanks for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you so much. We really have had and continue to have quite a journey, and it's a pretty amazing experience, and we just feel very, very fortunate to be able to help people really live their dream with horses, and appreciate everybody dialing in and everything that you do, Melinda, because it's everybody's shared love of horses that, to me, I think we're just chipping away at making this world a better place for our horses that we love so much, and a better place for ourselves.
Yeah. Well, Karen, I know we were up at the horse fair this weekend, and I had several people come up, where's Karen? We want Karen here in Indiana. And we're working on that. And so for those listening, know that we're still trying to get dates on that. I've been kind of tied up with Mike's dad's estate stuff. It looks like that's coming to kind of some closure maybe. And so we'll be able to focus and get some dates out for people that want to come into Indiana and stay with us. So had a lot of positive feedback of people wanting to do that. So we're ready to get those dates out. So
be sure to do that. There's an article that's coming out in Western Horseman magazine in May. They came out and did the article and did the photos and interview and everything last summer. So we're pretty excited about that. I'm excited about seeing how Western Horseman, I've had such respect for that magazine. I've been reading that magazine as long as I can remember, and I was just, you know, so honored and pleased that they would want to share this perspective that helps so many people to their readership. We're very excited about the opportunity for that kind of exposure and being able to help even more people this year and the year.
Now, what issue is that? What issue is that that's coming up?
The May issue.
Really? Oh, how exciting.
Yeah.
You know, you were here last year doing a magazine article, and Nancy's trees were all in bright bloom. Well, they're like that again. It's beautiful. Remember the real pinks and stuff on her tree?
Oh. Yeah, the magnolia tree. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I couldn't think of the name of the tree, but yeah, spring is here. So, well, we really appreciate everybody joining us tonight, and know that Karen and I can talk all night. So we will let everybody go.
People can.
Yeah, so please join us next month, and we'll get your questions in. Make sure you get those in and submit them to us. So, Karen, you have a safe evening tonight, and you and Mike enjoy your night.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.